Career Curves is pleased to have Groove, maker of the Career Clarity Toolkit, as our sponsor. Are you feeling stuck or trying to figure out what's next in your career? The Career Clarity Toolkit uses design thinking, guided reflection, and career experiments to give you confidence. Go to careercurves.com/groove to get started. As a special promotion for Career Curves listeners, use the discount code CURVES to receive 10% off your first order. Many people wonder if it's possible to take something they're passionate about and make it the focal point of their career. Some decide that they can't and have side hustles or volunteer gigs devoted to their passions while supporting themselves with a day job. Some, like our guest today, work hard to combine their work and their passion. Welcome to Career Curves, where we talk to people who have had interesting careers and explore how they got to where they are today. Today we're joined by Manny Hernandez, who shares his difficult journey and how he ultimately combined his passion and his career. Manny is currently the Senior Vice President of Culture and Learning at Livongo, a Silicon Valley startup focused on empowering people with chronic conditions to live better and healthier lives. He studied electrical engineering in Venezuela and then started his career at Procter & Gamble, where he held a variety of positions, including Manager of Electricity and Instrumentation, Line Manager for the Diaper Production Line, and Education and Recruiting Manager. He then curved into web development and moved to the U.S. We started our conversation about 6 years into his career when he was the Project Manager and Customer Service Manager at Group Tech International in Phoenix, Arizona. I started the interview by asking Manny about the news he received that changed the trajectory of his career.
In 2002, I was diagnosed with diabetes. It was a shock, and it kind of set the stage for things to follow. It exposed me to peers, others like myself, who would be basically insulin pump users that I met as part of a support group. And that that connection, that sense of belonging, that sense of like relating with the people around the table was like a very pivotal point in my life. It made me feel like there could be an opportunity in translating that experience into something that others could have, and doing so in a virtual manner. So that kind of set the stage for things.
What was it in your background that made you think that was something you could do?
How far back do you want to go?
As far back as you want.
So I'm an electrical engineer by training. I went to school for that. So I had a background in technology to begin with. Subsequently, I went into web product development. It equipped me with enough information and training to be dangerous and to realize that there was a possibility to take what was in existence at the time. We're talking the time where MySpace was all the rage. So social media in its early stage. So taking that concept and adapting it to people with diabetes, to create a space where people could find virtually what I was able to find in that room surrounded by my peers in an insulin pump users support group.
And why was that community so important to you that you wanted to recreate that for others?
What I felt and what I learned in a matter of 1 hour surrounded by my peers in that support group was unlike anything that I have felt in my life before. But I guess when you are diagnosed with a chronic condition like diabetes, a lot of things go through your mind. And one of them is a sense of like, you know, am I the only one feeling this? Am I the only one thinking this? Until that meeting, as crazy as it may sound, I hadn't met anybody else outside of my family members with diabetes who live with it. So it limited my ability to just ask questions and just be able to relate to what others were going through. I can remember distinctively how going around the room, there was like some introductions and people were talking about how they were going about their everyday, why they came in that day, what were some of the challenges they were experiencing. And almost every single word that came out of their mouths, I said, like, I know what you mean. I mean, I can relate to that. This is exactly what I go through. It doesn't really matter how supportive of a family or a network of friends you have. It's different if you don't have the condition. So to be able to relate to them at that level was hugely important. So I felt there was something there. Around that time, too, I read a book by a journalist called Thomas Friedman called The World is Flat. And there was a reference in there about exploring the use of social media for more than socializing, right? And so those two elements combined kind of gave birth to what followed, which was our decision to find a suitable platform to create two online communities for people with diabetes, one in English called 2diabetes.org and one in Spanish called estudiabetes.org.
How did you find this space in your life to pursue this passion?
This was the second shift, so to speak. At the time, I was working in a college in Central Florida called Full Sail University. I was the web product manager for the internal online experience for students, for staff. I would do this during the day, and I loved it. I had a great friend as my boss, who was also from Venezuela, where I'm from, and we would talk about these things that I was thinking about. So when I would get home, I would sit down, you know, after dinner and dive in and spend probably until like midnight or 1 a.m. almost every day working on this and thinking in the back of my head, wouldn't it be awesome if I could do this, if this were my job, so to speak? And fast forward, and eventually we made that happen. And I say we because my wife became a central part of this along with me. You know, we're our yin and yang. So I'm an engineer by training. She is a designer, an architect, an artist by training. So we complement each other very well in that respect. So I brought in like the thinking in a more structural fashion about how do we build this community, how do we do this, how do we
what's the technology,
and she would make it look amazing. So it was a second shift type of job, something we would do after hours, and she half jokes to this day and says that she joined me because like. Otherwise, like, what kind of time would she have to spend with me?
I was going to ask about that. Tell me about some of the decisions you were making during this point, about how you were creating for yourself work-life balance.
I can't say there was much or almost any work-life balance, to be honest. And I think that comes when you find something that you just are so passionate about that just doing it is what you want to do. And so you almost have to go out of your way to make sure that that doesn't completely take over your life. But I was working, and so was my wife, Andreina, crazy hours to bring this to life, yes.
At some point, somebody had to say, we have to rethink this. You know, it's not going to work indefinitely to be working full-time on a job and then doing your own thing, you know, in the evenings and then sleeping for a fraction, a small amount of hours, and then doing it all over again. What caused that next wave of change? How did that happen?
I guess deep within me, I held on to the dream of turning this into what I could dedicate my life to. But at the same time, as probably most engineers, I was like extremely practical. And I also enjoyed, you know, my day job and was looking at how I could potentially further, you know, my career in that space. And so I started exploring opportunities in the West Coast, in the Bay Area specifically. And it is not without irony that one of the opportunities that materialized eventually was with the very company that I was using as the platform for the communities that we built. At the time, it was independently owned. It was called the Ning, N-I-N-G. It subsequently got acquired. But I came out to interview, and it was like, it was a great fit because I was an example of what could be done with their platform to grow a community. So fast forward a few months, we moved to Palo Alto, and I took a job with them. This is a startup, and as any startup, I was working really, really, really crazy hours and still doing the second shift thing. So this is early 2008, and a friend of ours gives us the opportunity to stand by their booth at the American Diabetes Association Expo in Santa Clara in California. And we stand there and we're handing out flyers promoting the two communities, like just grassroots, you know, raising awareness. And along comes this guy wearing khaki shorts. So totally not looking like what he was. So he was an executive from a firm that was working with Johnson & Johnson, who had identified the work that we were doing in these two communities, and in particular a program that we developed called Word in Your Hand, where we had members write on the write on the palm of their hand a word that described how they felt about life with diabetes, and post it. So super simple. So this is, again, today, of course, there's like Instagram and like, so there's an overload of images. Back then it was Flickr. That was kind of it. So this gentleman approached me and tells me that he had been trying to get a hold of me for a while, and he wanted to meet us in their office in San Francisco to show us what they think we could do.
How are you feeling at this moment?
I was in disbelief. I was in complete disbelief. It's like, you gotta be kidding me. Because like this was in my mind at this time, it's like Andreina and I, it's like just like going nuts at, you know, until 1 a.m. Totally not sustainable, basically. And with a dream in the back of our heads, we were still pushing, but it wasn't easy. And like, there was not a business plan. There was like not like a clear end in sight. We just keep pushing. And next day we show up at their office and we were just blown away. Like these guys had really done their homework, and they had a vision for a cause marketing campaign, leveraging this particular program. And fast forward, it took several months, but essentially that seed money allowed us to basically launch a nonprofit, which became Diabetes Hands Foundation. We then subsequently plugged the two communities as the first programs of the foundation, and that gave us our start.
Was that enough money for you to be able to leave Ning?
Yes. And so that was effectively the time when, and it was on, it was a very short stint there. I was only 4 months.
Yeah, I was
going to
ask you about that. Yeah. So, because I think one of the challenges that people sometimes have is they take a job and then they feel like they are beholden to it for a certain amount of time. How did you manage that exit from Ning?
The story with Ning is interesting because, in a way, for us to succeed meant that they had a great success story as well to tell. So they were very supportive. In fact, following my exit, which was very above board, very transparent, and, you know, super respectful terms, they connected me with the folks from the For Dummies series. And I ended up authoring the Ning for Dummies book, which sold a stunning few copies. But I am a firm believer, no matter where you are and why you leave, about the importance of always being very transparent and always being very professional, because you never know who could you run into next, and like, that stays with you. You know, if you burn those bridges, that stays with you.
Or if nothing else, your dignity, right, stays
absolutely
intact. All right. So now you're, I think you mentioned that you're a year that you were doing the foundation still at your home. Did it get to a point where you moved it out of the kitchen, dining room, and every other room of your house?
With the money we got, we were able to launch the foundation. It was our seed money, if you may. But there was a clear leap of faith. There was clarity about the fact that we were not going to have enough money to take us through the year. So we were going to have to beg and borrow, not steal, and to bridge the gap, because it was a multi-year agreement. So there was like at the next January and the following January, there would be a fresh amount that would be received. And I cannot describe it in any other way, like a belief that it was just the right thing to do. It's kind of like now or never.
Yeah.
And this is 2008. So it's not the best time to quit a secure job. But nevertheless, like, you know, at least knowing that there would be this cushion that we could rely on and then get as sharp as we could and do it as fast as we could, start to diversify our funding sources became our, you know, priority, along with continuing to develop the communities.
I want to talk just a little bit more about leap of faith that you mentioned, because I think it's important for people to understand when you would advise a leap of faith and when you wouldn't.
What I would say about leaps of faith is that it is super important for you to be attentive to the signs around you. What do I mean by that? I went to school for a challenging degree. Electrical engineering is not easy. I didn't close the doors to opportunities I could explore. If I saw something that was interesting or attractive, I would try it. For example, I was involved with the school newspaper. I was involved with the student council. I was involved with a short-lived science and technology publication. Some of those were, I was just trying things, you know, and I found things that I liked and things that I didn't like. I've kept that as almost like a norm that I follow, I stick to just always stay open. And it began, honestly, with even my choice of major. I didn't really know exactly what I wanted to do. You think probably most of your listeners can relate to that. And this is like, I'm dating myself. This is like 1989, and I don't know what to do. And my dad got me a big catalog from McMaster University in Canada, and I start just like browsing through it to see what speaks to me. And I saw some classes in the biomedical engineering degree that sounded interesting. So I guess there was a little bit of the seed of like doing something ultimately with a goal of helping others or enabling others. We didn't have it biomedical engineering in Venezuela back then. I don't think we have now either. But so the closest thing was electrical engineering. So it's kind of that, like, okay, keep yourself open, don't box yourself. And I guess you could say, okay, after all the effort and time you put into getting a degree in electrical engineering, like, you might as well do it, right? And, you know, don't change. Like, but in my first job out of grad school, my first 3 years were doing engineering or industrial or production engineering work. And then my last year was doing HR because I discovered I had this passion for people and people development and like identifying the right talent and bringing them in and then helping them grow and shine and excel. And the head of HR at that location saw that in me and said, like, do you want to join me? It's like, sure. I guess the counter side of that is like, do I have this like grand vision of like, you know, as they take that next step? Sometimes not. Sometimes like I do, like in the case of the leap of faith, like there was always that driving force of like, this is what I would really like to do if I could. So we were afforded the opportunity and it wasn't perfect. And I think that's the other piece of advice. Like if you wait for the perfect time, you may never do it. So, and that is not just with career changes, but with decisions at work. So you're going to have to operate under circumstances where you don't have all the elements and you need to make the absolute best decision you can with what you have
in
front of you.
And you've even shared already, you're an engineer, so very pragmatic. So even recognizing that even as an engineer, I'm not going to have all the facts and there's a time that I'm going to have to make a leap of faith. What I'm hearing also in your story, Manny, that I think is really interesting is when you talk about opening up a lot of doors and exploring a lot, that gave you a versatility so that when there were some different opportunities, whether it was the HR person early in your career saying, I see something in you, or just some other shifts you're making, that there's probably a
ability to walk through some of those opportunities because you're like, oh, I've got a lot of doors open and I now have a comfort. Would you say that that's true?
Yeah. And I think also it's the comfort and the excitement that comes from having to learn something new. A new job, learn a new space. All I had when I had my first HR role back, this was in with Procter & Gamble back in Venezuela, was a profound belief in the importance of people and developing them, you know, helping recruit the best talent, train them, et cetera, et cetera. That was it. I didn't have any background in HR. So I set on a journey to learn how to best do this, but it was always kind of like fueled by this passion for the topic.
So when you haven't known how to do something but have had the passion, how have you convinced others that you'll learn whatever the pieces are and that you can succeed even though you don't have those pieces?
Today, at age 47, at least I can refer back to the times that I've done it, right? So I've had to learn so many jobs or so many opportunities from scratch because there was no book about it or if there was, I just hadn't read it, so to speak. Another instance where this is also holds true was when we started the nonprofit. I had like absolutely zero experience in this, and so did my wife. So we went to get a copy of there's a publisher called Nolo that writes extraordinarily, you know, it's not for dummies level, but it's like accessible books on a variety of legal topics. And the book we got literally as we were forming a nonprofit, we did get actual proper legal advice too, I should say. But just to know what we were talking about was like how to form a nonprofit in California, which is where we were residing. And we just devoured it. So I would say in general, just like, seeing it as like something fun, interesting, you know, unknown territory, yes, like, but there's you're probably not the first person doing it. Finding someone you can talk to, learn from, ask questions to, seeing if they are willing. We did a lot of that early on, for example, with a nonprofit and built our networks grew in two areas. The diabetes sector, which was the sector we were serving, but also the nonprofit sector, learning from our peers and like finding best practices, going to conferences, or like listen to other people that have been there, done that.
So you have this passion around building this community, particularly around diabetes. You get the chance to form the foundation. How long were you able to keep the foundation going? Is it still going now? Take me through some more of the story. Fast forward a little bit.
The dissolution came in 2017. I left the foundation a couple years prior. And that was certainly one of those career curves, I guess more of a life curve that I was thrown. A few years earlier, my mother had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And as we learn more about this disease, we realize that what lies ahead is not an easy journey.
Yeah.
And it's certainly a journey that, regardless of where you live, but certainly in California with the cost of living, was not going to be one that we could afford. I had my salary from the foundation, and it was a salary that we could live on along with my wife's income. At that point, she had moved on from the foundation, so we had grown the team, so it was all good, but it was not, you know,
enough.
Furthermore, I had visibility into my mother's finances. I was her only child, so I knew how much she had in terms of savings that we could put towards her care. And so I knew exactly my runway. And I knew that by no later than March or April of the 2015, I was going to have to leave the foundation. Now, that transition has been one of the toughest ones in my life, because for the better part of a year, year and a half, I was looking for a way to make it work. Literally finding out a way where I could stay in the foundation, which I loved and wanted
and
to continue
built.
Doing.
Yeah.
While being in a position that I could afford my mother's care. Mm-hmm. At some point, mid-July, mid-August 2014, I hit a wall. And literally, I woke up to like what looked like just about any day, you know, the typical back-to-back type meeting packed day. And I looked at it and I froze. And I told my wife, it's like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I can't do any of this. It was like I was paralyzed. And I had some pretty important, one particular pretty important call I had to do. And he said, you're going to tell everyone that you've had an emergency and you have to cancel everything. And you're not lying. It's true. And you're going to rest and we're going to talk about this. And that evening, we just came to the conclusion that I just had to move on. So to the point of not burning bridges, of course, this was perhaps one of the most precious bridges to us. The following board meeting was one of the most intense and passionate I had ever been in, because I had already talked to the executive committee. They knew about the fact that I had to do this, and a lot of time was spent trying to figure out how to make it work. And in fact, they went as far as to saying, what if we increase your salary? It's like, the foundation can't pay me enough for me to stay. You know, what I'm going to need to make, it's not right for the foundation to pay me. I remember the attorneys that helped us early on in the foundation is like, you can pay yourself whatever you want. There's no law forbidding that. But what you have to think, you know, as a precedent, your salary is going to be public, because as a public charity, it appears in your tax returns for your organization. So just consider, how would you feel if that got disclosed in the, you know, front page of the San Francisco Chronicle? You know, yeah. If you feel it's fine with it, then great. And that stuck with me, but not
especially
only,
because as you shared earlier, you value transparency.
Yes.
And so here you're saying like, all right, I value transparency. This is going to require transparency. Yeah. And
at the end of the day, and what I told my board was like, this is my problem. This is my life. This is my situation. The foundation should not have to bend over backward to help me solve it. And at the end of the day, it was super hard to stay my ground, because I really had already made the decision. So I was not negotiating. But it was very touching, very humbling to see them try. And the next several months, it was a very long notice. Like this was in October, and I ended up leaving in April of the following year. They were spent on, you know, working on the communication, you know, to make sure that the transition did not undermine the foundation's position. You know, we had partnerships. At this point, we were working with everyone in the pharma and medical device space. So we wanted to make sure that those partners had the confidence in the continuity of the foundation. We went in to identify an interim CEO to replace me. I overlapped with her about 3 months. I was introducing her to everyone. So it was a very intentional and very thorough process that we went through in an attempt to protect the foundation and allow me the liberty to move on, really.
And so there actually were a couple of plates that you were spinning in that proverbial vaudeville plate spinning routine. So you're spinning the plate that says, how do I wind down my involvement in the foundation in a way that preserves it? Another plate, how do I ramp up the new replacement? Oh. Another plate, how do I take care of my mother, who during these months was probably continuing to decline, because unfortunately that's the nature of the condition. And there's another plate that you haven't yet mentioned, which was you had to find your next job.
Yes.
How were you doing that? How were you spinning that plate? Did you segment it off and go, I'm going to wind this down before I look for the next job? It doesn't sound like you had that kind of opportunity. What did you do?
Those months were very interesting. I learned a lot. I grew a lot as a person, as a professional. This was one of the times where I actually did put on my engineering hat and thought this through a lot in terms of like what was going to happen next. So I did the math as to how much I needed to make to begin with. I then started thinking about okay, so I have to move on from the foundation, but what are going to be the parameters that I'm going to have for myself for this job search coming up? First off, I wanted it, the next thing, to not be just a job. I wanted it to be something that I could really hang my hat on and say, like, I believe in this, I can get behind this, that this is, you know, being a part of something bigger than myself. And to be completely candid, for some time prior to this moment in my life, having been several years at this point in the nonprofit sector, I struggled with the idea that I could find that outside of the nonprofit sector. I now know that that's not the case, but that meant that part of my initial search included some of the larger nonprofits. The next parameter was like, how do I, what is one of the biggest assets I can bring to any future employer? And like, part of it had to do with like the relationships I had built in the diabetes space. So the non-compromise thing was like, it can't be just a job. And now the softer constraints, one of them is like, I think ideally I should stay in diabetes or chronic conditions. Like it makes sense. I can continue to build on that strength. Another parameter which was very practical and had a lot to do with family was trying to minimize the need for uprooting. So at a high level, try to stay in California, limit changes for my mother, who I learned subsequently, when you live with dementia or Alzheimer's, changes trigger, you know, a deterioration. So I tried to keep things as stable and unchanged as possible for her. So with those parameters in place, you know, I came up with a laundry list, right, of places where I could see myself working if there was an opportunity that could afford me the salary I needed to make. Also, for many years, I was like the president of the Diabetes Hands Foundation. But it was a small organization. Prior to that, I had senior titles. So like thinking through like, what is the my next title look like? What does my next responsibilities look like?
So not necessarily that title was that important to you because you had made these other moves. But if you're going to command the salary that you're
exactly
that you had identified you needed, exactly, then you had to recognize that title was going to be a part of it.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I started having confidential but candid conversations with a number of groups. On the nonprofit front, it became very apparent very quickly that, I just was super transparent. This is what I need to make. Just tell me if it's realistic or not.
Yeah.
And it became very apparent that it was not going to happen unless I was like the CEO of like, you know, some of the larger groups. So, okay, fine. So I then pivoted and focused solely on this other search. And earlier that summer, I had met Glenn Tolman. Glenn founded Livongo, where I am today. And Markendale eventually became the chief product officer and my first boss at Livongo. And we met for lunch. We met for lunch actually before I even had made the decision about moving on. But I really liked them. I really liked them as people, as leaders. I was very inspired by what I heard Glenn say.
What did they tell you at the time they were thinking of doing?
Already the vision was like crystal clear. In short, it was like a platform to empower people back then with diabetes, today with a variety of chronic conditions, to live better and healthier lives. And even the way they talked about it, the language they used, the words they did not use, the focus on the person living with a condition as opposed to the clinical environment surrounding them, like all of that appealed to me. It's like, I get it. Like I but again, I wasn't looking at that point yet. It was a great conversation, but like, let's keep in touch. And I subsequently contacted them and we initiated a dialogue. And a few months later, in May 2015, I ended up joining the company, which met absolutely all the criteria. Fortunately, there was definitely the kind of environment, the kind of product, the kind of mission that I saw myself getting behind and, you know, believing in deeply and supporting and telling others about proudly, but I could also put to great use that strength, that network, those relationships I had built early on. So that's where I've been since May of 2015.
So you make the move to Livongo. How's your mother, and how was your mother's health during this time?
Unfortunately, as expected, her condition continued to deteriorate. The same summer that we had dissolved the diabetes sensitization, so in August of 2017, she had a fall. While she was in the hospital recovering from the surgery she underwent, was the last time I heard her voice. The next few months were just like a very slow but steady slope where she deteriorated. And she passed away in early February of 2018.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. Thank you.
How did you manage your career at the same time that all this was going on?
It wasn't easy. It was honestly a very, actually, the bright side, the bright spot was in October of 2017, I started a new role at Livongo. I had been doing initially business development, subsequently product work, and I loved everything I had done so far. And there was an opportunity and a need to enter the people function. So since October 2017, I became the senior vice president for culture and learning. And it was, again, one of those like learning opportunities, but again, an opportunity to have a tremendous impact in the company and the people working there. You know, those same people were like nothing short of amazing. And they gave me the space, the time I needed to do what I needed to do to heal.
Yeah, that's really, it's quite a story, Manny. And I'm really thankful for you sharing it and being so candid. Couple of last questions.
Yes.
What would you say is the smartest career move you made, whether it was intentional or accidental?
I would say there's a tie, honestly, between the decision to leave Ning to start the foundation with my wife and the decision to join Livongo.
If there was anything in your career that you could get a do-over for, what would it be?
I don't think I would have studied electrical engineering. I think I might have studied systems engineering, or nowadays I would even say organizational psychology.
Yeah, as you're sitting in the HR people space.
Yeah, but I think, again, it was like a decision based on the best information I had at hand. But I'm pretty sure that if I knew what I know now, and if I had perhaps a bit more information, I would have gone a slightly different route.
What's one piece of career advice that you'd give your younger self?
Don't be afraid. You know, you might not see the light at the end of the tunnel. You know, gather the best, make the most complete picture you can with the information at hand. And move in the direction that feels right based on that.
Last question. How do you define success?
Being able to go to sleep at the end of the day and feel like you did your best, you gave it your all. And I think a perfect day is one where you did something where you helped someone else do the same. So if you can do that every day, I think that's success to me. That makes me very happy.
I love it. Manny, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. This is great. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Hey, listeners, before you go, I've got a quick epilogue for you. The Diabetes Hand Foundation Manny and his wife started dissolved in 2017. However, the online communities they created live on. You can find the English language community at 2diabetes.org. That's 2diabetes.org, and the Spanish language community at estudiabetes.org. That's estudiabetes.org. Links to both sites can be found on our website, careercurves.com, where you can find this episode, past episodes, and resources to help you in your career. As always, thanks for listening.